This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we are welcoming Nishi Kaula. And she is a novelist, a poet, playwright, academic, and here in her own words is Nishi Kaula.
Thank you, Grace, and thank you, everyone, for listening to my writings. This is my eighth collection of poems, Indigenized, Tribalized. In many ways, it represents a new direction in my writing. You know, although the questions at its heart have been present in my work for a very long time, I've always been interested in people who live at the margins of power, people whose voices are overlooked, whose histories are interrupted, whose identities are defined by others. So in this collection, Indigenized, Tribalized, it's kind of moving towards a question that has become increasingly urgent for me. What happens to a people when someone else tells their history? And the title itself, Indigenized, Tribalized, is deliberately unsettling. Of course, you know, the word indigenized can mean to be defined as indigenized by someone else's political or cultural vocabulary, and to be tribalized can reduce enormously diverse peoples and cultures into a single category, as though their identities could be kind of, you know, contained within one word. So I wanted the title to be as uncomfortable because the history behind those words is uncomfortable. So, you know, this book, Indigenized, Tribalized, I'm going to read one of the poems from it. It's titled First Rights. The land does not speak in words, but in the language of ash and sap. Its vowels, the curve of an elk's antler. Its consonants, the hum of stones. Worn smooth by countless knees, a birch tree remembers, hands tracing its bark, a lover memorizing skin, not to own, but to learn what it means to belong. Rivers do not flow, they bleed, their paths dark sutures, binding the earth's tender wounds, each ripple a gasp, each current a whisper. We were here before thirst was named. Mountains do not rise. They coil inward, their spines arching in silent defiance, holding the sky for those who knew its weight in stars before it was traded for wires. What is a boundary to the wind that knows the salt of every ocean, the musk of every pine? It slips through fence posts, gathers the embers of crushed sage, and carries it like a hymn. First rites are not seen. They are the shadow cast by a flame long extinguished, the smell of cedar smoke lingering in a hollowed out cave where echoes refuse to fade. May I just speak a little about the poem, First Rites?
Well, it's a beautiful poem. I was enraptured by it. And I have known your political activism for many years in your art form. So I do want to remind people, as I opened, that you have published 11 plays, 3 novels, and 8 books of poetry, and several art films. So while we're talking about poetry, tell us about these books. How do you feel the same story is being told in every book? How do you feel your latest book is different from your first book? I want you to look at the canon of your poetry and remark upon it for us. Nishi Kaula.
It's interesting you comment on my political activism, because to me, you know, it's very nuanced. It's very subtle. I wouldn't really kind of call myself a political activist, you know, in terms of its dictionary definition. But I do care for human rights a lot. I do care for how people have been, like, for instance, in this collection, indigenous people have been kind of marginalized. I do care for how history is kind of written by those in power, and how the histories of those who do not matter has been erased, has been somewhat distorted. I kind of, you know, so there is this kind of deep concern within my heart to correct and to address certain human wrongs that have persisted across. And that has kind of been the, you know, discovering a form of truth that I'm also kind of, you know, moving towards. How, for instance, for many cultures, especially indigenous cultures, land is not simply property. It is ancestry. It is memory. It is identity and survival. The destruction or appropriation of land therefore becomes much more than a political act. It can become an assault on memory itself. So, you know, through my various writings, I'm known to be a multi-genre writer.
That's true. You certainly are. You're multidimensional, Nishi, if anyone ever were, along being with an academic. But do you think your latest book of poems is more sophisticated in writing than your first? I maintain that sometimes our first books are just as good as our latest. But do you see a difference in your writing from the beginning?
I do see myself evolving in many ways. Now, I cannot comment on the quality of my poetry. Poetry can always be very subjective in how, you know, it's an act of, you know, personal judgment, where you may find my second collection on, like, you know, at that time we had just moved from India to the United States. That was 30 years ago. I didn't know much about Hindu mythology, though I've been a Hindu all my life by birth. You know, so I wanted to kind of, you know, there was this intellectual curiosity within me to know a little about Hindu mythology, Hindu religions, and I try to trace, you know, connections and parallels between Indian women, between the lives of Indian women and the lives of various Hindu goddesses. Now, some of the poems out there are extremely interesting. And, you know, then, of course, you know, in one of my recent collections of poems, Random Circles of Belief, I've always been kind of questioning religion. I feel religion can be a very divisive institution all along. So I wanted to kind of, you know, question all of that. And, you know, I'm grappling towards certain truths through various genres. And I think all along, through all of my 16 books, I'm trying to reach towards a certain truth that seems to elude me, that seems to defy me. And, you know,
somehow, that's because you have more to discover. Art is a process of discovering. And if I know you, you're always moving forward, you're always evolving, you're always discovering. And we never reach Ithaca, do we? But we do want another poem from Nishi Chawla.
Thank you. Thank you. May I? Then I can read from Random Circles of Belief. I'm going to read this poem, World Without Religion. My poem here embarks on a bold exploration of humanity's, so to say, fraught relationship with faith, with belief systems, and their profound impact on our kind of, you know, on our collective psyche and history. And, you know, here through some intricate imagery and some sharp, in my understanding, evocative images, this poem seems to present a tapestry of thoughts, you know, that question the implications and consequences of a world that perhaps was stripped of religion. Let me read it out for you. World without religion, some hope for it after inflicting endless misery in reaching out to grab the other by the sternum of a wasteful object. As it deepens, we display their severed heads, garnished in cheap wine, false glitter, of our false convictions, consumed with real passion. We coat it with textured bodies of ancient relics, brew and blend them with stones grown out of our own struggles to see through the calm and philosophy of religion. Restless with new whimsies, social discontent echoed in Beatles-like longings, imagined religious notes coming alive, palpable with the harmony and peace of our waning beliefs, evolve, carve fine details as a timekeeper would a cultural mix, insert and attach, retract, then redraw what the Greeks and Carthaginians claimed as their own. When the Romans and the Phoenicians called for new religions, and the Arabs and the Christians have stopped singing Fleetwood Mac songs, reuniting the skies with the waters, the soils and earths with animals and birds, their birthplaces gone through the region of architectural composition. They only talk about oceans and lands that connect us with their borders, plot the story of love beyond divisions, beyond the differences of our gods, their process of understanding an ancient rock that disturbs the inner core with precision, or one who studies the infallible nature of its comforts. Without its tongue and its sharp teeth, only teaching. So, you know, at its core, this poem is, you know, where I'm trying to grapple with the dichotomy of religion as both a harbinger of hope, so to say.
Yes, but it's clear. You don't actually, it doesn't need any editorial comment because your words are very powerful. They're very accessible. They're very clear. And everything, all your poetry books are written in English, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I know that you are a novelist as well, and I two questions that are related. One, how do you write a novel? If you can encapsulate this as briefly as possible. And two, how do you begin a novel? How do you even begin this journey, this marathon? It's intrepid.
Interesting. This is my third novel, Silent Walls, Speaking Stones, that was published in November 2025, after almost 25 years. I had published my first two novels about 25 years ago. The first one was about a separatist movement in India. We had barely moved from India to the United States. I was just teaching one course. I had finished my PhD at GW, and I was kind of twiddling my thumbs, not knowing what to do. Of course, you know, taking care of my family, my sons, who were very young at that time. And, you know, I kind of did a lot of research and published my first novel, The Twist of Truth, that happened to coincide with 9/11. And it's at its core, it is about, you know, that philosophical question of one person's terrorist is another person's patriot. Then I wrote my second novel was I turned it into a movie also a couple of years ago, after looking for, you know, people who could kind of produce and direct my movie. That was a human silicon chip about how, and I think it was kind of prescient in many ways. How did I know 25 years ago, when I was, you know, barely in my early 40s, how did I know that technology could create such huge social divisions, the appropriation of wealth within just kind of, you know, a few people's hands? And this novel is about two brothers, one who kind of is very passionate about liberal arts, and the one and the second brother who moves into technology and kind of, you know, creates or is kind of becomes an entrepreneur, and the growing sibling rivalry between them.
And well, you really have whet our appetite. Would you be able to read us a bit?
Sure. I will read this novel, Silent Walls, Speaking Stones, which I think does need a certain prelude for my American audiences, at least, because it is, you know, it is not polemical, it is not political, but very often, if I say it is set, the novel is set in Ayodhya. Now that kind of, you know, kind of creates a certain tension in the minds and hearts of people who imagine it is a political novel. But as Toni Morrison said, you know, all good art can be political, but it need not be polemical. My aim in this novel, which was published only last year after 5 years of deep research, you know, kind of was to kind of show a very balanced perspective on what happened in Ayodhya, one of the religious towns in India.
Well, we would love a little taste of it. Can you read us a page or two?
I'll read it, please. Yes, I'll read it. I'll read it. This is about a young girl, Sanvi Trivedi, whose mother is Muslim, whose dad is Hindu, and who also becomes the architect of the Hindu temple in Ayodhya, which, you know, has created a lot of polarization, a lot of divisions within India itself, especially after the Babri Masjid was demolished on December 6, 1992, the day my protagonist Sanvi Trivedi is born. So I'm not trying to create any, you know, support any ideological cause in this novel. I'm just trying to look at it from the point of the view of Hindus who are a majority in India and who felt aggrieved when Babur, one of the Mughal kings, came and he destroyed the Hindu temple. And then in 1992, you know, the Hindu government demolished the mosque. And in 2025, they established this huge Hindu temple there. So obviously, you know, it created, 1992 was a time when it kind of, you know, it led to this violent rupture within the communal and religious landscape of India. India has never been the same for the past 25 or 30 years. And so my novel is in many ways, you know, kind of just that effort I make to look at things from both sides and to show how multiple truths can coexist at the same time. Let me read this, one page from the novel. For a long time, I couldn't reconcile the two worlds I saw. The one where my father was the political man, the man who commanded respect, and the one where he was someone else entirely, drawn to Yasmin, that's her mother, the protagonist's mother, in a way that defied reason. I realized that I would never fully understand the complexities of their relationship, nor would I ever be able to fully comprehend the depth of what I had witnessed that night. But the memory of it shaped me, shaped the way I saw love and connection, and left me with questions that I would carry with me into adulthood. As I grew up, I learned that the things we witness as children are often the things that shape us the most. The things we don't fully understand, the things we can't articulate, are the things that stay with us the longest. And for me, that night, that primal scene became a shadow that lingered in the corners of my mind, unresolved but deeply etched into my being. I knew that despite the physical distance and the seeming separation that defined their lives, the bond between my father, Ramesh, and my mother, Yasmin Khan, could never break. It was a connection that neither time nor circumstance could sever. One that thrummed beneath the surface, quietly enduring in the shadows of their lives. Though he had taken me from her after my birth, it was clear that something deeper than parental duty or legal rights was at play between them. For years, they maintained an intimate, clandestine relationship that was as much about the weight of shared history as it was about something more profound, an unspoken yearning that neither could extinguish, even as they lived separate lives. Ramesh, my father, was a man driven by ambition, his eyes constantly set on the next step, the next rung in the political ladder. His world was full of speeches, handshakes, and the carefully constructed narratives that he wove around his public persona. But in the silence of the night, away from the eyes of the world, he was a different man. Yasmin was his tether to something more real, more visceral. The politics, the career, even the expectations of his family, all of that was distant when she was near. There was a quiet, secret place where they met, an unspoken pact between them. A space where the complexities of religion, culture, and family dynamics faded into the background. I always sensed the passion they held for each other, even as a child, although I never had the words for it then. Thank you.
Beautiful prose. You can write in every genre. And what interests me is your plays and your films, and I have seen some of them. And what do you say about the difference between writing for a film and writing for the stage? How is that different?
Well, there are certain subtle differences. Writing for, you need to have a more visual sense in writing for, well, my films were, these are art house films that I kind of, that actually take off, that are adaptation of my plays, except for one film that was, of course, my second novel. So it's kind of more immediate, more kind of, it needs to have a more, a different kind of impact. Stage is, you need to have dialogues do matter, not that they don't matter in a film, and how to pitch, a film, it requires a different market orientation than how to kind of, negotiate your words, your words and the roles that the characters play. Now, the actors, of course, definitely play a huge role, whether it is in a film or a stage play. A stage play is within the kind of constraints of maybe 2 hours. A film could be kind of, very often these days, actors do prefer to act in films, not for the money. There is no money in art house films, simply no money for the producer, director, or for the actors. But it's more for the shelf life because a film can stay longer. Much longer. A stage play is a lot of actors are now resistant to acting in a play because it means it requires a lot of memory skills, a lot more effort and time in remembering their roles, in coming together as a group. Whereas, films these days, of course, you just kind of shoot one particular scene and then you move on to the next and the next. So,
Yes. You actually directed your films, didn't you?
I did.
Did you
Yes.
co-direct them?
No, I
You
directed.
actually were hands-on in production.
Yes, I did look for a director. I looked for a film producer, and they were asking for a lot of money, short of selling my own house. That's the only thing that we have, apart from a good pension. You kind of so I was left to my own resources, and I decided, okay, and I learned the ropes. I kind of, learned a lot about directing and about putting a film together. I think I'm a pretty organized person, and I
I
was
think
able
that
to.
being an academic, you're basically pretty well putting the pieces together. And since this is the poet and the poem, let us hear another poem from Nishi Chawla.
Oh, okay.
We're
Another
going to
poem.
cover all her edges today, her
Okay.
prismatic products.
Okay. May I read from Indigenized,
We love
Tribalized?
it.
I went to India recently, a month ago, and it was very well received. And people just loved how I was able to cover indigenous communities from, not just from India or the United States, but across the various continents. And it was very well received. I've had some wonderful reviews, and I think I did a pretty good job, though it meant a lot of work, a lot of work, so to say. But let me read this poem. This is from an Indian artists, audiences, Adivasis. Should I read Adivasis? This is on page 107. The forest does not need a name. It was here before names, before Jharkhand was Jharkhand, before Chhattisgarh was carved from rock, before borders and deeds and maps, the Gonds, the Santhals, the Bhils, walked paths of Mahua and Sal, these are trees and flowers, their feet writing histories into the soil. They move like wind threading bamboo groves, their language unbound by weight of scripts, each syllable a river bending through time, unwritten, carved into earth's remembering. The Nagas, Mizos, Khasis, mountain echoes, feet steady on shifting clouds, drums beating beneath the skin of the night, history not archived, not sung, but danced. The trees remember, the rivers hold the songs of hands grinding millet on stone, of women weaving bamboo into shelter, of gods who do not sit in temples, but live in the fire and the hunt, in the whisper of leaves before the monsoon. They say land belongs to the one who fences it, to the ones who write its worth in numbers. But whose hands lifted the first grain from the earth? Whose children knew the taste of fruit before orchards were walled and sold? Who spoke to the hills before machines drilled their silence away? In Neamgiri, they stood before the bulldozers, said no to the men in suits, no to the holes blasted into sacred mountains, no to the factories that feed on the bones of the land. They stood as they always have, with nothing but their voices, with nothing but the right to remain. The earth is not a resource, it is a rhythm, a breath. Beneath the feet, rice, millet, and maua grow in time with the rain. The forest gives what is needed and no more. The hunt is not a conquest. It is a prayer to the spirit of the beast, a pact between hunger and life, between those who take and those who return. The gods live in stone and tree, in the hands that till, in the feet that dance. The harvest is a song, the rain is an offering. No scripture is needed for belief, only the sight of the mahua blooming at night, only the sound of the river speaking in the night. They do not own the land, and so they belong to it.
You are a creative machine, for sure. You are a creative machine. You just funnel in those words from the universe, I'm sure. And speaking of your organizational abilities in producing films and plays, that was the same skill it took to put together two anthologies which were global, put out by Penguin. One was Greening the Earth, and one is Singing in the Dark, and they were both poetry anthologies. Now, I happen to know what went into that. I know how you had to go through submissions, organizations, communication with all these difficult poets, communication with a publisher, and yet they exist, and they are really classic anthologies. You should be very proud of that.
Thank you.
And I guess it's because you've been done doctoral research. If you could do anything, you can jump through any hoop. But since we have you here for such a short time, we'd love to hear one more page from that novel, because you set it up so well. We're in the ethos. All we need is another little reading from it, because we're already there with you.
Very nice. Thank you. Thank you. I'd love to. Yes. Let me read. The novel is, of course, a struggle for Sanvi, her struggle towards self-awareness. And the last section of the novel is, you know, I describe in great detail, in intimate detail, how the Rama temple, Ram is the huge god, so to say, you know, epic god for the Hindus. And the Ram temple is being constructed, and she watches with a certain amount of self-embarrassment. She cannot explain to herself, you know, what's happening. And she's grappling with the kind of euphoria, the happiness that the Hindus are kind of, you know, experiencing as the new temple, which they had lost 400 years ago when the Mughal king, Babur had come from Central Asia, and he tore down the Ram temple and built a mosque. And what the Muslims are experiencing, because part of her is Muslim, her mother is Muslim. So, you know, I'm just going to kind of read from page 394. Even as I reflect on my father's legacy, I find myself drawn to the rivers that define this place, as if they carry answers to questions I have yet to fully form. My blood is both Ganga and Sariyu. And in this place where the rivers once met, I now search for the peace that eluded my ancestors. Perhaps in embracing both sides, I can become whole. I stand on the bank, watching the waters flow, each current whispering stories of long forgotten lives, battles fought, and sacrifices made. The Ganga flows with a fierce, unrelenting purpose, some 60 miles or more from where I am. And the Ganga is a holy river for for all Hindus. It carries the wisdom from distant mountains. And the Sariyu flows in Ayodhya, where I have traveled a couple of times. And the Sariyu moves in quiet dignity, her depths mirroring the strength of all those who held their ground here against tide and time. As the river's currents intertwine in my mind, I sense a deeper truth that Ayodhya's story is not merely a tale of division or conflict, but of connections waiting to be rediscovered. In the silence of this moment, I realize that my blood, drawn from both these rivers, is neither divided nor conflicted, but intertwined. The voices of my ancestors, those who spoke different languages and tongues, prayed to different gods, dreamed different dreams, all converge here within me, asking for nothing but to be heard, honored, and at last set free. Perhaps by listening to each voice without judgment, I can find the peace they never knew. Perhaps by embracing both rivers within me, I can finally become whole. My dual legacy, I realize now, can bring me inner peace only through my acceptance of my heritage. I was born in Ram's city and raised with Allah's name on my tongue, a child shaped by two heritages that still hesitate to breathe the same air. Standing here in Ayodhya, a place where history trembles beneath our feet, I sometimes wonder, can I carry both legacies? Or must one always eclipse the other? In Ayodhya, where every stone remembers, I often ask myself, must I choose one past over the other? Or is it possible to live with both folded into my being? I close my eyes and the air hums, not with nostalgia, but with presence. Time presses close. Saints, kings, rebels, lovers, their voices hang in the trees, etched into thresholds and courtyards. I'm not whole in the usual sense. I'm made of misfitting pieces, voices in different tongues, gestures from different homes, names that don't always sit comfortably, sit side by side. Now, as an adult, I stand on the soil that carries both dreams and scars. How can one place hold so much? Ayodhya, the birthplace of a god, the place where a mosque once stood, a city where faith collided and left a wound that has never fully healed. I realize that my life, too, is a kind of Ayodhya, a land of contested memories, a land where belonging feels both undeniable and impossible. Thank you.
Nishi Chawla, I think you have an unending talent, and we will be reading, we will be looking for all your names on your books. Do you have a website?
I do.
Okay.
Nishichawla.com, well, yes.
So it's pronounced, it's spelled N-I-S-H-I-C-H-A-W-L-A. If you Google that, you'll get the resources. And she taught English for 40 years, and yet she saved some of that wording and verbiage for herself. And in honor of the name of this program, please read us a closing poem.
I shall do so. I want to read a poem just as much as my protagonist from my latest novel, Silent Walls, realizes that history is not always a wound. History is not what happened. We can also build bridges. So in some of my poems, I try to build bridges. I'll read this poem, which I personally like, Almost Two Sisters, Almost Sita and Mary. So Sita is the Hindu goddess, the wife of Ram. She was, her parents were King Janak of Mithila and Sunena. And Mary's parents were Hokem and Anna. Sita had two sons. Mary had one. I've not known seas older than this earth and older than the heart that throbs within me. I sing Ave Maria and wonder what it means to crush my child to my golden bosom until it spills all its gold. I then light a candle and turn my soul to the east. I sit on a red lotus and look around me. My 10 eyes and 5 heads can turn all around. I hear the seed churn. I hear it mix some nectar with a dash of cosmic poison, a little moonlight, and this branch of a tree. I meditate, Dhimahi, upon 2 foundling sisters, 2 earth goddesses, one sprung from a furrow in a field freshly ploughed, and the other from soil past bearing any fruit. I bathe in ancient seas that sprung an immaculate conception on one. The other looked upon 2, not 1 son, as her own. But I still hear them singing together in their sisterly moments. They sit on that hammock while the wind whistles, strums, soft songs of love in their ears, stirring desire that one was told to repress. Lulled to their fate, fated to be mothers, fated not to know physical love. I've known only the mother that grows deep within me. I've not known seas. Thank you.
The voice of Nishi Chawla. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the funders, the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, and friends of the program, Natalie Canavore, Avidesha Shani, Yong Ki Kim Renault, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. And we want to thank our engineer, Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.